Thank you, Sebastian. Thanks for the invitation to give this talk today. It's a Blackboard talk, and please ask questions whenever possible, whenever you need to, rather not whenever possible, whenever you need to. This is work done with Astrid Icon and her student Fleur Verstegen. She just put out in the archives recently. So I'm going to outline of my talk is as follows. Again, please let me know if things are visible far away. I'll begin with this idea of geometric reconstruction. This is a term that I find useful in the context of causal set theory, and in particular, the so-called Hartle, King, McCarthy, Malamant, sometimes Levitrev theorem. And reminding you of this theorem, which is the main motivator, in a sense, for causal set theory. And I'll give a brief, go over briefly about this space versus space-time discussion, specifically in the context of causal set theory. I will introduce causal set theory here, and I realize now that maybe most people haven't heard it, so I'll try a very brief summary of it, and apologies to those of you to whom this is not familiar, but in the interest of time, I think I can't give a full-fledged introduction to causal sets, but I'll try my best. It's actually fairly simple at some level, so hopefully you can at least understand the construction. And then I'll go through a continuum construction of the predistance in the mathematical sense of when you're constructing a distance function, and then the distance function, which is a spatial distance function, which basically is a title of the talk, which is using space-time causal structure to construct a spatial induced distance function. And then the causal set construction, which follows almost trivially from this continuum version, and then some thoughts about looking ahead, what are the questions that we ultimately wish to answer. So let me begin with the first, which is this HKMML theorem, which is a theorem in Lorentzian geometry, which is very powerful, which states that if a causal bijection, and I'll explain what I mean by this, exists between two spacetimes, M1, G1, and M2, G2, which are, and they have to be future and past distinguishing. This is a causality condition. This is a condition, a global causality condition on the space-time. So it's very weak. You're not requiring them just to be causal, but you need a little bit more structure here. But, okay. Then these space-times, then they are conformally isometric. In other words, G1 and G2 are related by a conformal transformation. What does a causal bijection mean? Now, for every causal spacetime, underlying every causal spacetime is a causal structure poset. So for M1, there's a causal structure poset, and by this, what is a poset? it's a partial, what I mean by poset is a partially ordered set where M1 now, we think of M1 as a manifold, but you have to think of it as just a collection of events. And there's an order relation between the events, which is acyclic, which means there are no closed time-like or causal curves. And it's transitive, which means that X precedes Y and Y precedes Z implies that X precedes Z. Okay, so the transitivity condition holds. And that's all the structure here. It's just an ordered, partially ordered set. It's partial because there are events that are space-like to each other. Okay. So the causal bijection is basically telling you that there is a bijection. By this we mean the following, that there's a bijection between these two spaces, right? Between these two sets. Yeah.
If you don't assume this global condition, is there a counterexample to this? It seems like a very local thing. Like locally, I can reconstruct the metric. So it's hard to see why I need a global condition.
Yes, you need a global condition because the statement is completely global, right? I mean, you're saying that everywhere, that there's a, first of all, that you have a bijection between, okay, so causality itself, you require these posets to be, so if I just tell you what a conformal isometry is, maybe then you'll see why the global causality condition is important. Globally, these things have to match. But maybe you're asking a slightly different question.
Well,
you're saying, why is the proof not more general? I think it's just harder.
It seems like I can just locally, I can argue that the metrics have to be equal up to some.
No, but causality is something that requires all of space. I mean, this is the whole point of global causality conditions. You know, the whole study of causal structure in space-time is that you can have locally, everything looks perfectly fine. It looks like Lorentzian space-time. We know that even causality is not guaranteed that way. Causality is a global causality, I mean, causality, not having closed time-like curves, is a global condition. It's not a local condition.
Oh, so for example, are you trying to rule out something where I would take, like, Minkowski space and, like, compactify it?
I mean, that's the simplest example I can think of, but that's exactly where looking locally is not enough.
Okay.
I mean, if I look locally and I could match a space-time that has closed time-like curves and one that doesn't. And that, to me, would not be a causal bijection, right? Okay. And so this is a causal bijection if X precedes Y in yes.
Well, why don't you finish that sentence?
Sure. X precedes Y in M1 if and only if, and this is a two-way statement, that okay, so the causal relations, the partially ordered set, is mapped bijectively one to the other. That's basically the statement, okay? Sure.
I think I have a question, it's maybe the same intuition, but maybe there's something stronger which is true. Supposing you don't satisfy the conditions of a causal bijection, supposing one space-time is Minkowski space-time, the other space-time is conformally related to Minkowski space-time, but there are a finite number of pairs of points which are identified. You still have the conclusion that there's a conformal isometry, even if you violate the causal isometry, the causal bijection of the finite number of places.
No, because then that's not possible without violating the conform. I mean, it can't be strictly conformally related. I mean, there'll be boundary points or something you'll have to look. I mean, these special points will have to be exceptions to that. Yeah. Okay, so this is just the starting point, just the motivation for causal set theory, and this is where. What does this theorem tell you? It tells you that this structure, this partially ordered set, has a huge amount of information about the Lorentzian space-time. Yes?
Ordered set, and you said it doesn't have acyclic.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that necessarily mean it's future and past?
So this is stronger than the condition of causality. Distinguishability means that, let me write it right here.
It means that you can't have two points x and y, for example, whose future sets, complete future sets, are identical. If they were, then they wouldn't be future distinguishable, and likewise past. So that means that somehow the causal structure is enough to resolve points, you know? It gives every point a causal character, which is like its fingerprint, right? Yeah.
Is last condition only the implication or if and only
if? This just means, yeah, this is if and only if, and this is a causal bijection, and, you know, if you start with the other one, so, yeah. So here we have the poset, and what this is saying is that the space-time can be made up of this poset plus the conformal factor, which I'm going to call the volume form, okay, the volume element. If I put these two together, and maybe I should actually write a little smaller, but is this visible? Yes? Is it visible? Okay. Then this is equal to G. Okay? That this is the space-time. If I have this poset and I put in an extra element of the volume element information, then I will get the Lorentzian space-time. This is where causal set takes off, where we have the partially ordered set. And instead of having an external volume element, volume comes from the causal set by putting in the condition of local finiteness, which is the discreteness condition, tells you that between these two events, you have only a finite number of fundamental space-time events. Okay? So it's an atomistic idea, but yes.
If I think of volume form like the determinant of G, it's like a scalar.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's precisely.
Everything that is not contained in the scalar part is actually can be summarized by just being the causal structure. Is that possible?
Yes. So this is what Finkelstein said very long ago, when he was before people really had this theorem, before there's a sense. And this is an idea that's been around for a while. Various people have explored, you know, what makes Lorentzian spacetime different? Is it just like a Riemannian spacetime with a weird signature on it? Or is there something fundamental? And importantly, this poset structure does not exist in any other signature space. So even if you take minus, minus, plus, plus, it's not a poset. So it's very clearly related to the Lorentzian character of spacetime. Okay, so the idea then is, so one idea, and this is what I will do in the this part of the talk, in the continuum construction, to say, well, let's stand everything on its head and just derive things from these two, derive familiar quantities from these two. And at the back of my mind, of course, that helps me then construct things in the causal set using just the causal structure and the volume element. Okay, so that's the idea and that's the motivation. Okay, and I guess one little point that I should make is that using the causal structure is also ultimately how we measure things. Actually, it's far more operational in some sense than one might imagine, because we can't really measure things that are space-like separated. We're always measuring things that are, we have to, you know, everything is done within our light cone. We can't step out of our light cone to do measurements. So it's actually very functional or operationalist point of view to take the causal structure and then to build things out of the causal structure. Okay. So that brings me to the second part of my talk, where I'm going to talk a little bit about causal sets. I'll erase this here, but please remember that these are the two pieces that we need. So it is space versus space-time. And in a sense, when we think of space, when we think of canonical gravity, we have a formulation where we think of a moment of time, and we're looking at defining canonical variables, so an induced metric with its extrinsic curvature to give us a position momentum and then the phase space constructed out of that. And the other is just to look at space-time as a whole. And of course, in terms of quantizing gravity, as we even discussed yesterday, this can have, these two approaches can be very different. They can lead to different things. But for today's talk, I'm not even going to go there. I'm just going to talk about the fact that while space-time and looking at path integrals and sum over histories may be the natural thing for causal sets or other approaches to quantum gravity, there is something nice about the canonical approach in the sense that it's given us a lot of information. We are able to write down an initial value formulation. We know how to talk about predictability and so on. So it's a useful thing to have this, have some sort of canonical picture in mind. And this is a bit of a challenge in causal sets. So although I don't think it's fundamentally important, and it's something that should be emergent, because we really want to stick with space-time, fully covariant things, it's always a useful thing to be able to say, well, what is the induced metric at a moment of time? Okay, and so that's basically where this whole talk is headed, to try to get a useful definition of an induced metric, spatial induced metric. So why is it a problem in a causal set? So I just told you what a post set is and sort of told you approximately what a causal set is, saying that it's a locally finite, partially ordered set. Since there's so many of you who may not have had any introduction to causal sets at all, let me summarize by saying that we replace space and time by a locally finite set, locally finite, which basically says that it's fundamentally discrete. Finite space-time regions have finite number of fundamental space-time atoms. But in this, we also want to, in this approach, we not only want to throw away space-time, we also want to be able to see when it is that we will recover space-time. And how will you recognize a causal set that looks like space-time? Because you've thrown away the continuum, and now suppose your dynamics throws up something, then I'd like to be able to recognize to see whether it looks anything like space-time. So geometric reconstruction is basically the idea that you want to start off with a causal structure and reconstruct things that look more familiar, that look like the kind of continuum geometry features that we all like to see. So how do we do that in the causal set? What do we call a continuum-like causal set is one which, and let me just say this very briefly without being very careful, if I have a space-time, then from this I can extract an ensemble of causal sets by doing a Poisson sprinkling, okay? Although my theory is not restricted to these, right? Here I'm only looking at the corner of the theory where I'd like to look at continuum-like causal sets. Most causal sets don't look like the continuum, so the theory is much bigger. But in this continuum approximation of the theory, I would like to know when a causal set looks like space-time. So given a space-time, I can get an ensemble of causal sets from it via a Poisson sprinkling, okay? Via Poisson's process. Which tells me what the probability of finding n elements in a given space-time volume region, okay? And that gives me an ensemble of possible causal sets. And these are the things that I'm going to call continuum-like. The ones that are typical in this ensemble are what I'm going to call continuum-like, okay? So if you think about Minkowski space-time, and I did a Poisson sprinkling, then one very important feature of it, because this volume here is a space-time volume, and we often forget Lorentzian volumes, that they've got this very peculiar feature that if you think about this point here and the volume here is the same as the volume here and all the way up the light cone, which means that what I get is a very highly non-local structure because it's not a Riemannian volume, which is like a nearby region, which is how we know how to think about Riemannian geometry. But this is a hyperboloid because the Lorentz group is non-compact. Okay? This is something we've learned in special relativity, but I think we all forget very quickly. But it's basically this feature, a discretization that you get, which preserves Lorentz symmetry. Okay, so this is, you get Lorentz invariance without, you get discreteness without breaking Lorentz invariance. Okay, so I'm not going to go into this at all. I'm going to assume that we kind of understand where this is coming from. This means that nearest neighbors for x can go way up the light cone. In Minkowski spacetime, the nearest neighbor elements are infinite for every point. So it's a highly non-local graph that's constructed. So this is an important feature. So please stop me if it sounds... I'm condensing a lot here. OK, so what is the problem we have in recovering spatial structure in a causal set? It's precisely coming from this feature that you really need to look at nearest neighbors that are very non-local. In a given frame, they could be very, very far away with respect to a given frame, yeah.
So in that exponential, mm-hmm. That's like a Boltzmann line?
No, it's just a Poisson distribution.
Oh, okay.
It's just a Poisson distribution. Just classical, it's just sprinkling. If you did it in a Riemannian context, you'd just basically sprinkle with respect to the spatial volume, and you'd get out a structure. Here we're doing it with respect to the space-time volume. So now let me think of such a Poisson distribution, a sprinkling. And this is meant to be, and now we're saying we want to get something like space out of this. All of these are connected, they're causally related, etc. I'm not drawing in the causal relations because it'll look really messy. So what is the analog of a spatial hypersurface? That's the first question to ask. And it's an obvious thing to look for are sets of unrelated points, okay? But really, I want something like a Cauchy hypersurface. What does a Cauchy hypersurface do? It divides the spacetime into its past and its future. Not only that, of course, it's also the summary of its past, which means that I can put in initial data there and I can predict everything about the future from there. So here, therefore, I want to make sure that I include all possible, I make the set maximal in the sense that everything that's not in the set is either to its future or to its past. Okay? So this is what I call an anti-chain. And this is my analog of, a spatial hypersurface. Sorry? If I had, the only time it wouldn't exist is if I had a completely ordered set. I mean, and then I would still have it, but it would just be contain one element. Yeah.
So every element to the future has a past element which is in the anti-chain.
Yes.
When you include enough things in the anti-chain,
it is. That, yes. And nevertheless, it can't be a summary of the past because of the following. And this has entirely to do with the fact that you have these links that can be very far up the light cone. So even though I have something that looks like a candidate for a Cauchy hypersurface, I can, if I consider these two points here, and this is all in Minkowski spacetime, I can have a situation where I have four points of this kind, where these two are linked to each other. When I say link, I mean that it's not mediated through anything in this anti-chain. Okay? There's no mediation through the anti-chain. So even though the past of this I mean, it belongs to the past of this, and this belongs to the future. There's a relationship between these two, a fundamental, irreducible relationship between these two, which is not captured by the anti-chain.
Now, if you erase the vertical line of the
here, or here,
yeah.
then I would say, yeah, because it has to be, that's right, so this has to be related to, because I've used this to divide these, the whole causal set into its future and its past. So this is a what I call a maximal or an inextendable anti-chain. Okay.
Could there be two events in this anti-chain which are to cause the reason?
No. So they're mutually every it's like a Cauchy hypersurface. Everything is causally unrelated. It's completely space-like. And it's maximal in the sense, sorry.
But then if I think that, I mean, this is very vague, that information propagates along the links, this is not enough to know what happens.
Absolutely. That's right.
It's not.
So exactly what I'm trying to say, that therefore information propagates. And rather than being a Cauchy hypersurface, it's what Raphael calls a Cauchy sieve. Okay? Just lets everything through. But, yeah. So now the question is,
but it's kind of consistent with having a very non-local action.
Exactly.
So the action that user took a action is very non-local. So you would need infinite derivatives because the machine would need infinite many steps.
That's right. So the point is that, but on the, so this is a problem. So you mean this is a quote unquote a problem in the sense that if you wanted to get any spatial information, it's very hard. Okay. But let's leave that aside for a moment and ask. Yeah.
Can you fine grain your causal set and just add a point in the middle, and then we have something?
Yes, but you'll always have many more. If the one way to think about it, and I mean, it's sort of when I first realized these things, I used to call them missing links, but it bothered me a lot because I thought, well, you know, then that means we can't somehow talk about predictability. But if you think about it from this, the perspective of this coordinate system, this frame, these are highly boosted events, so very, very high energy things that you couldn't possibly see, and right? So if it is dense enough, if it's sufficiently dense, then you imagine. But I will tell you another way of thinking about this, which presumably is also how we should think about these anti-chains, which is that if I... So let's just ask... Let me try to ask then. Forget about the Cauchy, the issue of it not being Cauchy, but I can simply ask, well, what is the metric on this? What is the induced metric on it? And let me just look at the anti-chain and ask, what is the structure that I have on it? Because the only structure that is there are causal relations. If I look at the anti-chain, then it's just looking at it head on, it's just a bunch of points unrelated to each other. There's no structure whatsoever. It's a discrete topology with no information because these are just space-like related, and the only information that's there is in the causal structure. So there's absolutely no information in the anti-chain. And the only topology that you have is a discrete topology. It's just dust. Okay? So how do we get information? How do we ever reconstruct information on the anti-chain? And the idea which we used several years ago to calculate the homology of the causal set was to actually thicken this a little, borrow information from the neighborhood, okay? So the idea is to borrow the information, the causal structure in the neighborhood of the anti-chain to induce structure on the anti-chain, okay? And it was the first thing that we had done years ago was to look at the homology of the space-time, and we could reconstruct it very nicely using this. So in other words, we want to look at the light cones of elements that are to the future or to the past and see how they intersect this set. Okay? And those intersections give us an open cover, And from that, you can construct something called a nerve simplicial complex, etc. But I'm not going to say anything about that today, but just say that I can use a similar construction now to induce a metric, and get an induced metric on the antichain. Okay? And I'm going to do this very naively. And to help me along, I'm going to forget about the fact that I started off with a causal set and just ask the question in the continuum. Okay? Let me see, I'll use this. So in the continuum as well, I want to use just this and the volume element to construct the distance function on sigma. So the very convoluted way of doing it, you would just take, you know, take the normal, you would calculate what the induced metric is if you had the metric. But here I'm trying to be very contrarian and say I insist that I want to start off with just the causal structure and epsilon and the volume element and try to reconstruct the distance function. So the construction is actually, so I'm just going to construct, any distance, so given any space, I can construct a distance function. It may not, so the one that I normally think of as the induced distance is one that I get from the space-time metric, right? I mean, I just look at the normal to this, I project it, project the metric onto the perpendicular subspace to the normal, and I get out my induced metric. So that's one induced metric, but I'm going to propose another.
I'm just saying that those
it's a distance.
Ways to define distance.
That's right. So, but this is just a distance function in the sense that it satisfies the triangle inequality, has all the properties of a distance function.
Just
a general distance function. And actually, the construction is very simple, which means that I think I will be able to finish my talk. But in order to give you a sense of what I'm doing, I want to step back away from Lorentzian geometry and think about just a curve gamma in R2. Okay? It's just sitting on this plane. And I want to be able to use the metric on this space to induce a distance on this curve. Okay? And I want to do it not just between, say, the endpoints P and Q. I want to do it everywhere along the curve. So the idea that we're going to use is something like a piecewise linearization of the curve. And of course, if I did that, if I did, you know, picked a bunch of points like this, then I can say that I'm using the ambient, so let's call it the ambient metric, to define the induced metric. In a simple way. I just use straight line segments and I break up the curve. And what this gives me is a piecewise linearization of the curve, a specific piecewise linearization. And I can calculate the distance using just the ambient metric, which in this case is just flat. Okay? So for a given, so let me call this some particular discretization of gamma k, of gamma, I can get the distance between p and q for this gamma omega discretization, which is just the sum over the pieces, which are just the R2 right?
So you assume that your points are ordered.
I'm just using this as an example, and then we'll see, just to sort of give you a sense of how, you know, a handle of what exactly one is going to do. And really the construction is very simple, but because of the fact that, So this, obviously, means that, you know, if I have regions of high curvature, if I'm comparing this with the actual induced metric, the actual distance on the curve, then my approximation gets better when I'm representing places with great more curvature. I mean, the regions of higher curvature have more points, then I will get a better approximation, right? I mean, this is just something that's obvious. Now, what I want to be able to do, I don't want a discretization of gamma. I want to use the discretization. This is actually kind of key because this can be a bit confusing. I want to use this discretization to get a distance function for all points on gamma. Okay? So which means that I can't just stick to one particular discretization because that one discretization will not contain all the points. I want to get a full distance function on gamma this way. So I might think of the following, which is that if I think of, you know, so in other words, I have all possible discretizations that I would like to sum over, I would like to vary over, in the same way that I would vary over all possible paths when calculating a distance. So in Riemannian geometry, I know that if I have different paths, you know, alpha, beta, gamma, so different paths alpha, then I basically look at the path length, okay, between P and Q, and I extremize over this. In Riemannian geometry, I minimize over this to get out the right distance function. That's what you do in Riemannian geometry. But here, of course, if I did something that naive, if I just looked at all possible discretizations and then tried to minimize over them, the one you can imagine that the one that is the least good approximation will give me the shortest distance, because I'm not actually using the distance on the curve. I'm borrowing the distance from the region that it's sitting in, right? The ambient metric. So in order to make this approximation good, I have to limit the size of these subsequent patches, right? I mean that each of these has to, each pair, subsequent pair, has to be in a substantially small region. So I need to introduce a scale. And this sounds very bizarre because you can say, well, you know, why not just look at a finer and finer refinement? But what I'm trying to do is to say that, well, if I want to get all possible points between, if I want to get a distance function on all of gamma, then I have to vary over all discretizations. But then how do I decide? The only way to decide is to minimize it. But if I minimized it, and here clearly if I minimized it, I will get a very bad approximation. Okay? Because, for example, in this case, if I try to minimize over all omega k, I would get the straight line that joins this and this, which would be a really poor approximation of the induced distance. So in order to get a better induced distance, I should make sure that the subsequent omega I plus 1 are in a small enough neighborhood. And in this very, very simple example, I can do that as follows. So in other words, what I want to do is introduce something called a mesoscale, which is going to tell me that if I look at this suspended area, okay, and I can do this in two dimensions. I can't do it in higher dimensions, but this is a useful enough example. I can say that this area has to be less than sum L squared. So I can get, using a minimization procedure over all omega k, so taking the infimum of all distances varying over all omega k, I can get a distance function on this curve, okay, which is whose accuracy, okay, so if I compare with this, so let me just call it, with the actual distance is always less than some value, okay? It's always less than some. So I can always get a fine enough approximation by choosing this cutoff. Okay, and it's a mesoscale because it's somewhere between the discreteness scale and the full, you know, curvature scale of your theory. Okay, so this is just something to keep in mind. I realize I have not that much time, so yeah.
Yeah, so
go ahead.
I just pointed out you need it to be large enough so that there's always points. There's always a next point that you can jump to. If you made it too small, like some discreteness scale, there might be no connected curve.
Yeah, so I want to vary. In fact, in this, I will vary over. I'm not going to fix the number of points I have k at all. I will just vary over all possible k's. And then say that for every choice, I can get an arbitrarily accurate, as long as the suspended area is small enough.
Here we're still in the continuum.
Yeah, we're still in the continuum. So we've not, so let me just say this a bit more carefully. So D is defined between any two BQ, the distance function, is by taking the infimum over all omega k. Okay? Sorry, is this more visible? Yeah? Yeah. So infimum over all omega k, all possible discretizations, but so k is not a fixed number, right? All possible discretizations over, but such that I limit, you know, I have to, so if I did this in the naivest way, I would get the crudest approximation, right? Because this curvature is always positive in this simple example, I'll always get the worst approximation possible. So, but if I limit the subsequent ones to some, to something to make sure that they're smaller than some particular length scale given by the suspended area, then I will, so if I put in that extra condition in here, then the claim is that this difference between this and the actual induced distance can be made arbitrarily small depending on that particular suspended area, you know, the choice of that. So this is the idea, that you're trying to get a good enough approximation of the distance function using the induced metric and using the ambient metric, not, you know. So we just want to use that information and not have to define a new metric on the spatial, on the curve itself. We're just using the ambient metric and seeing how to. And this is just meant to be an example. So the Lorentzian case is obviously far more, actually, it's not far more complicated, so that's a nice thing. And I'm, for lack of time, I'm just going to give you the simplest example, and you'll have to trust me that in the curve case, in the more complicated examples, this very simple, naive way of defining distance actually can work very well as long as you pick this mesoscale carefully. Sorry. Oh, there's another one here? Oh, okay. Oh, very good. All right. So let me quickly jump into the Lorentzian case. Sorry. And in the Lorentzian case, let's do the simplest thing, which is just Mn. In any dimension, let me call it MD, I think. N's that appear elsewhere. And let me take a inertial hypersurface, you know, in T equal to constant in an inertial frame. It's an inertial frame. And what I'm going to do is look at two points P and Q. Look at their futures, okay? So, and look at the common future, which I'm going to call f of bq, this thing here. And in particular, because I'm in the continuum and I can do it, I'm going to look at this. This I cannot lift, I guess. So I'm going to look at this hyperboloid. Oops. which is the intersection of the boundaries of these light cones. And what do I get with the intersection of the boundaries? I have an n minus 2 dimensional hyperbola. N minus 2 dimensional space-like hyperbola, which is this set here. Okay? And now I can look at the past of any element which belongs to this. And I can look at J minus of H intersection of J plus of sigma, which is this light cone here. And I'm doing it for any point along H, right? I'm just looking at this past light cone up to sigma. Okay, just a light cone, but cut by sigma, all right? Yeah? And what I notice, and the reason for doing it in such an elaborate way is because it generalizes very easily. Let me call this the volume of this region here. Okay, volume of that past, of that light cone. And if I take any H here, then of course, because of the fact that P and Q are related, they're going to lie. If I take the cross section of this with this light cone, so I have this cross section here, okay, of any point here. And if little h belongs to this hyperboloid, then P and Q must lie on the boundary of this cross section, because it's just null related. Okay? But clearly, at the minimum, and here I can define a minimum because I've chosen an inertial frame, right? When it's minimum, I think I should draw this more carefully, but you can see that in general it's like this. But when I have H minimum, these two are actually diametrically opposite each other. So I don't know, does this look diametrically opposite? Not really, okay. So if I look at this cross section for H min, then this beam is such that P and Q are diametrically opposite each other, okay? So that means that if I vary along this, I'll come to a point, which here is very obvious because I have coordinate systems to work with, everything is really simple. I just look at its beam onto the hypersurface, and P and Q are diametrically opposite it. So I have a very nice situation where I have P and Q for H min, which are diametrically opposite each other. This is just a time, and I've got 2t. And now I have the volume here to the past, and I know that the volume of the half cone is related to the proper time in a very simple way. And that's what I'm going to do. There's some dimension-dependent constant times t to the d. So I'm going to How do I measure big T? This is a construction in the continuum. So I have all my coordinates and everything.
Okay.
So I'm not actually going to use it. I'm going to use it as an intermediary to then, say, define the full. Okay, so I hope this picture is clear. I'm just going to define the full.
You're going to calculate the volume and infer.
That's right. I know I'm not going to infer T, I'm just going to take dpq and say that this is V H min upon. Okay? And this is sort of that's all I'm going to do.
Yeah, that is good.
So I'm not even worrying about T, I'm just making it a proxy for the distance between P and Q. Okay? So here it's just 2T, yes. Yeah, that's why I can do it here, right? I mean, yeah. So this very naive formula turns out that we can use it knowing that there's an error that will creep in. This is exact in the flat space-time case. This is exactly the distance. But every time you introduce curvature, and this is what we did, we put in, you know, extrinsic curvature. If you put in a constant extrinsic curvature, sigma with a constant extrinsic curvature, and explicitly work it out, you find that, yes, this here differs from the induced metric, but the amount of error that creeps in can be controlled by, again, like we saw in the curve, controlling the size of this. And controlling the size of the suspended area is the same as taking sigma and saying, we're going this far and no further. Okay? Yeah? This is sort of, this is our cutoff, if you like, a mesoscale cutoff. And when you do, you can, in the continuum, if you also take sigma to be compact, so that you have compactness is important because then you have a local, you actually have a finite open covering. And you can say that for every epsilon, I can get as accurate a distance as I want using just this very naive formula. Okay? But I haven't said everything that I should say right now. Let me just say that this, again, when we come to the curved space-time case, there's a very nice formula that you can write down using Gaussian normal coordinates and Riemann normal coordinates, which gives you a formula, and this is what we use to actually calculate the Gibbons-Hawking-York term for causal sets using this volume element. But in this is just a differential geometry result that the volume of this in a small enough neighborhood, in a general small enough neighborhood, where you're using both a Gaussian normal neighborhood associated with sigma as well as a Riemann normal neighborhood, that the volume just looks like the flat volume of the half cone plus some, you know, some dimension dependent thing here, which we know explicitly, times k times t, where k is evaluated at this uniquely determined point here, because it's in a Gaussian normal neighborhood, there's a unique geodesic going from here to here, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So use of all of these Gaussian normal neighborhood, Riemann normal neighborhood, means that we're in a situation without caustics, which means that much of this structure can still be carried through carefully. You know, you're looking at futures of light cones and so on, this hyperboloid, at least a section of that hyperboloid is still there for you to access and for you to do this construction. So what is interesting, very interesting about this is that when you calculate the volume of the causal of a causal diamond, you actually get the higher curvature terms. But they don't appear, obviously, for dimensional reasons at this order. So you really looking at the constant curvature case is a good enough, gives you a good enough handle. The other thing is that here I've sort of used the fact that these sections are round, right? And in general, in a curved space-time, they'll be wobbly. But to this order, and this is something we proved a very long time ago, was that when calculating these volumes, is that to this order, there is no change in the light cone. Any changes in the light cone structure, you know, the eccentricity changes only to higher order. So you can strictly go about doing this and even in the continuum get out something that is arbitrarily good. I mean, as arbitrarily accurate as you want. Okay? So that's the continuum construction. And then you just have to believe me. Of course, we have to construct the distance, which means we have to also do things like looking at all possible paths, minimizing over all possible paths, but given that we have this mesoscale cutoff, we can do that, et cetera. Now, what happens in a causal set is that we don't have the full, we don't have the boundaries of light cones. We have causal. So if this is my anti-chain, I'm sorry, but is it okay if I go over by maybe?
There were
question. So
sorry? Okay. So in a causal set, because of the Poisson distribution, you know, sets of, you think of null lines and null rays, they're sets of measure zero. The boundaries of light cones are sets of measure zero. They're not represented in a causal set because of the Poisson distribution. It's, right? So you're not going to get that hyperbola in the causal set. But nevertheless, so this common future will have some points in it. But nevertheless, because of local finiteness, it becomes actually quite simple to say that there will be an element here which will minimize the past volume up to this. Okay, that's all you need. You need something that's just going to minimize. It's the smallest past volume up to this. And there should be an element like that that minimizes it. Because it's locally finite, that's not a problem, right? I mean, in the continuum, we have to be careful in general that there always exists such a thing and that it's within, you know, within this region that you've picked. But here, there's no such issue. So you can do the same sort of thing, and there's a discrete now. As you can see, the thing that I should say is that what have we used? We've used, in the continuum, we've used script H, which was the hyperboloid. That needed the causal structure. And then you use a volume element, right? The two ingredients we've used, that's it. And to do the same here, we're going to use this volume, the discrete version of this volume, to extract a discrete version of the distance function. What happens in the causal set is that when you're very close to the discreteness scale, this region is very poorly populated. Okay, it's when you're close to the discreteness scale, the fluctuations are very large. And so the closest point that you get in the common future can be really far away. So really what you're doing is you're measuring this big diameter rather than this smaller one. Okay? And this is what we had earlier sort of dubbed discrete asymptotic silence, because it's as if these two events can't really communicate to each other. If you have two observers and they're sending light cones, light rays, light beams, which need to sort of meet somewhere, they don't, in the continuum, they would meet here at H min. But in the causal set, for any signal to meet takes a much longer time. So in some effective sense, and again, I hesitate to say it as strongly, there is a kind of narrowing of light cones, if you like. Okay? But it's in this effective sense, if you were to think purely from the spatial perspective. So there is an asymptotic silence, but it turns out that but once you go beyond that scale, so we have the discreteness scale, which I call L Planck, you have the asymptotic silence scale, and you have the scale of curvature, which you're trying to make sure that things are small enough compared to the scale of curvature. And so you want to put your mesoscale somewhere here. And you're asking, well, if I do that, will it be sensitive to that mesoscale? So what we did, and this is a good part of the work that Fleur did, was to simulate these causal sets. So what I'm going to do is now use my slides, the last few minutes, to show you the simulations we did to show how well this description works to give you a distance function in the causal set. This is all magical. Okay. So that's an example of a sprinkling. One thing that you have to worry about is because this anti-chain, you want to be able to compare it with a continuum distance function. You want to say, how well does this discrete distance function approximate the continuum? For that, you have to tell me what the continuum is. Given an anti-chain, because it's so sparse, I have a uncountable infinity of hypersurfaces that could fit it, right? It's just some discrete set of points. I could just wiggle it around anyway. The way to think about this hypersurface is to think of it as a piecewise linearization, or the anti-chain as a sort of piecewise linearization of of these surfaces. So here's a case where we're looking at the minimal anti-chain. That's the red points. We're going to try to see what to do for the, you know, we vary the curvature of this and try to see whether you can use the causal structure to extract information. And these are sort of the numbers of points that were sprinkled, 58,000 elements for d equals 2 and d equals 3 was 75,000. But we're very restricted by numbers because we can't go to four dimensions very easily since this anti-chain itself becomes then too sparse. But it's computationally very intensive, this particular thing. So this is in flat space-time, and what the first curve is for the pre-distance function, and we're comparing it with a continuum. And you can see that when k is equal to 0, that you recover this. So this part that is here is the region of asymptotic silence where the... So first, before I say anything about that, I think it's completely erased. But on the left, the y-axis is the error. So the continuum minus the discrete upon the continuum. Okay, that's the error in the discrete distance. And the first one, we've drawn the predistance function, which is without this minimization procedure, which minimization really takes a lot of computational effort because you have to do it over all possible sets of points. And you can see that it actually works extremely well. And here the mesoscale has been chosen to be infinite. In fact, there is, even though they look very similar, there's quite a lot of difference. You do get a vast improvement when you calculate the distance function. Now, this takes a lot of time to load because these are very heavy PDF files. So, okay, there you go. And then when you vary the cutoff, and you take the cutoff very close to the region of asymptotic silence, then you really get a very, fairly poor, I mean, again, it's not terrible, but it's much poorer than if you chose a cutoff in a sensible place. And there's sort of a stable regime where the cutoff doesn't, which is not shown here, where it doesn't matter which cutoff you use, but you get pretty much the same distance function. And then if you take it very big, again, in the flat case, it doesn't matter, but matter too much. And somehow things just... Sorry, yeah.
What does the points below 0 represent?
Just an overestimation or an underestimation of the distance. So you're typically you're overestimating the distance, which is why the curve kind of goes up, especially in the asymptotic silence region. When you underestimate it, then it'll go down. And this is a sort of a scatter plot, so there will be points that will underestimate and so on. Okay, there you go. So this is for different curvatures, and we're still using the future, so the positive and negative aren't exactly the same because we're still using the same direction in which we're doing the thickening. We're doing it to the future. So as you can see, when you take L to be very large out here, when you take it to be infinity, it's basically beyond the curvature scale. And there's the discrepancy starts to become significant. But there's, again, this region around in the middle where the distance function works very well. OK, just to say that we also did this in d equals to 3. And there, the asymptotic silence scale is smaller. But you also get these fattish-looking curves. But yeah, I mean, it seems to do fairly well. What's interesting is to then, all of this is just comparison with a continuum, but you can say, well, intrinsically, how do you know that what you have is right? We did a comparison between just taking the distance function and putting in, if you remember, the formula has a dimension dependence in it. And you put in the wrong dimension in two dimensions, and you get something that, I might have not put it in here. Sorry, I didn't put this in here, but you actually get you get a curve that looks like it is convex upwards or concave upwards, okay? Rather than something that's convex, and you get the right I'm trying to hurry up, but this y-axis is actually doing something on the anti-chain, which is saying how many elements do you have at a distance d from any given point, right? You're looking at the spatial volume by just counting, and you're comparing that with the distance. So if it is in flat space-time, that volume has a very clear relationship. And so we're trying to plot that. And we find that there's a good... So in the first case, things... If you take L to be too small, then the linearity is slowly sort of violated, the expected linearity of the volume, because it's just, you know, the distance is the volume. That linearity is violated, but it once you go away from that, you have very good, you get a very nice linear curve. When you have curvature in d equals 3, for example, you get the expected quadratic behavior, which is what will happen with a two-dimensional ball. So two-dimensional circle, right? So let me just end with this. Let me just end with this and say that, just say a few words. I mean, I guess I'm over time, but... Just very briefly say a few words, just summarize, to say that why is this interesting? Why is it interesting to get spatial information? Like I said, one is simply the challenge of doing it, because it's an interesting question. We'd like to be able to compare things with what people do in other areas. Just to summarize, there's sort of three things that are in our immediate future, which is to look at a spectral dimension using this, because now we have structure, spatial structure, we can look for spectral dimension. That's something that we started to look at. The other is try to calculate a sort of Ricci curvature using the techniques of Olivier, to calculate a more geometric information. Apart from the interest in just sort of reproducing things about space-time that we know, parts of space-time geometry, I think this is also potentially useful when we're studying the double path integral, and we want to, for example, calculate a decoherence function between two causal sets. The question has always been, we know in the continuum that the final hypersurfaces have to match for unitarity. Quote unquote unitarity, but in order to match the final surfaces, this is one way of actually having geometric information rather than just information about the cardinality. So these are directions in the future. Thank you. Thanks.
We had several questions, maybe one or two very urgent questions. Yes.
Do you have any ideas on how to treat the coarse grinding of these kind of moments?
In what specific way?
Well, could you really reproduce a continuum space time out of starting from causal sets?
Right, so there are several ways to answer this. I'm going to try to do it the quickest way I can. One is that one of the fundamental assumptions in causal set theory is that there is no continuum limit to the theory. We talk about continuum approximations. We talk about things, the causal set is locally finite, which means that there's a fundamental discreteness. We don't look for continuum limits. Having said that, sometimes it's useful to look for continuum limits, and we do that when we're calculating things that are continuum-like. Very often we take the limit in which the density goes to infinity, and because that's an easier limit to calculate, and things become simpler. So yes, there are certain things that do limit over certain, that's what the idea is, that whenever you're doing geometric reconstruction, whatever discrete structure you want it to then give you in the right limit, the continuum quantity that you thought you were looking for. And that we've done in several instances. And that's sort of the idea here too, that in the continuum limit, of course, this will, because that's the reason to do the continuum structure. Say that in the continuum, this thing works. So if you took the continuum limit of causal set theory, this thing that you had would also move over to this. Of course, you have this additional question of error, but then as we saw, we can always limit that error. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to end it here, but somewhat you will be around for the next 2 weeks, so you still have plenty of opportunity to ask the questions. Let's think again.